fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life becomes exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart? For as rich as you are, it's much better by far to be young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive just by being alive. Now here is the best part. You have a head start if you are amongst the very young at heart.
Good morning. I wanted to ask our listeners to please, if you can, look on Facebook, our Artist Experience Facebook page, and look at the images, because we're going to have a special interview today, and I'd like for all of you to see the work that goes along with the interview. If you can look at it while you're listening, you can also stream this program at TacomaRadio.org, and you can get this podcast of my show on the website, SheilaBlake.com, and on the artistexperience.com. So listen at any time, but try to see those images.
Oh, thank you, Sheila, for that. That's very important for this show especially. Well, good morning, everyone. Today we'll conclude our series of programs about success and the visual artist. We have had two wonderful shows with fabulous, eloquent visual artists to discuss their success stories from a young artist and a mid-career artist perspectives. We will finish the series today with the success and the mature artist. Sheila and I, as mature artists, will be discussing facing what the mature artist faces as a creative, practical, and philosophical points of view. How we define mature is, of course, is a major concern during this show, because certainly my mother, possibly some relatives, certainly some friends, and even people here at WOWD might question that maturity, possibly with me, but not you, Sheila. And you don't have to worry about this. It's my issue. And maybe in this hour program, we can really kind of zero in on specific artists and how they see their lives in all the years they've been making art. And we have a special guest here today on the interview. Sheila, why don't you introduce our special guest?
Sure. Well, Beverly McGinnis and I have been friends through thick and thin for 50 years. Bev and I met in Durham, North Carolina, when we both had little kids, and we kind of were little kids, and we were trying to make art. Bev was making a film called Durham, Land of Enchantment. We went down to the bus station with her camera, and we talked to these guys lounging on the benches. Durham was such a pit. It was completely decimated since integration and a white flight. And we laughed so hard, and we've just been friends ever since. So I don't have to say what a great friend she is, but she's also a fabulous artist and more recently a wonderful writer. So check out those pictures on the Artist Experience Facebook page. So to convince Bev to be on the show, I had to leave out two words, success and mature. But I wanted her to talk about her life, because at least for Bev and myself and Tom, our lives as artists are so winding and strange and precarious and just plain interesting. So, Bev, tell us where you're from. What was it like growing up in your family, where you went to school, and how you got to New Mexico?
Well, I think one of the things before we get going on that is to talk about, firstly, like what about this, as we're waiting for Bev, we've been making art for so many years. You know, what is it? How do we think about this maturity in our lives? And I think there's a few things we need to talk about. And I think the first thing we need to talk about is the creative process, which I find fascinating, and the journey about how do we become mature in the play of using our tools. And firstly, there's like the education on how you make art and learning how to use the tools of the trade, so to speak. Well, the mastery in the use of the tools and the medium, they don't just come overnight. I think a lot of people, you know, don't realize that you have to, you know, mature as an artist in the use of the tools. And in the East, like in Japan and China, that mastery comes through, you know, practice and in almost a spiritual sense. And I think that's the first thing we need to talk about when it comes to the maturity. And the second one is, how do we develop one's own personal vision? Like, you know, what do you want to say about the world, right? I mean, you know, what do you have to say? It's a matter of personal self-expression. And hopefully, for most artists, it's unique and it's powerful, and as powerful as the artist can express themselves about their world. The other thing is the maturation occurs in the developing the places to show your work, patronage and galleries, and that's huge because also we have to deal with the market. Well, you know, we're many mature artists in the 21st century and we have a growth curve, so we're going to welcome Bev now. And we got connected to the techno world of a phone interview. So we're going to welcome Bev. And Bev, are you on the line?
I am. You know, I was calling the wrong number.
Oh, Bev, don't worry. We forgive you. I've been calling the wrong number all my life. Anyway, thanks for joining us. We introduced you, and It's great to have you, and we appreciate your time and your energy. And we've told our listeners to go on our Facebook page and to see your wonderful works. And thank you so much for sharing them. They're absolutely marvelous. I've got to tell you. I mean, I was just goo goo gaga on that page with those images. But thank you for that. And we want to start with like. Bev, could you kind of tell us, like, maybe what a defining moment in your life that convinced you that art making is what you maybe needed as an imperative, and that what maybe you also wanted? What might you say that happened for you and how important it was?
Well, you know, I thought about that, and when I was a kid, we had this program. I was born in Toronto, and we had a old radio in our dining room. I was born in 1942, and it was one of those big old wooden radios. And there was a lot of conflict in my house, and my mother would set me down in the morning, and I would listen to kindergarten on the air, and she would give me construction paper and paste and crayons, and I would just go into my own world and listen to kindergarten on the air, and they would, I think it was about a half hour, they would tell stories and play music. And I just developed that longing for that private place and that secret place where there was no conflict. So I think that's how, that was a defining moment as a child. And then when I grew up, it seemed like all my defining moments, except for getting the Roswell Artist in Residency grant, were things that have been hard, things that haven't worked out. I didn't get to get an MFA. I only got an MA. They said I wasn't good enough to get an MFA. So, and then I went to North Carolina after graduate school. My husband got a job there, and I met Sheila, and we wanted to go to New York, so that didn't work out. And then I was in a gallery that sent back my work. It was in Colorado, and they sent back my work saying that they had more important artists. And that was a defining moment because I thought, well, what am I going to do? Who am I going to be as an artist? So I think most things other than being a child by that radio and getting the Roswell grant, most things have been things that haven't worked out.
So, Beth, tell about getting the Roswell grant. Tell about where you were in your life and when you got it, because I was there.
Well, I was in North Carolina, and I was away from anybody that made ceramics. In California, everybody that makes ceramics is kind of understood, and there's a huge support system for that. And I had just had a child, and I thought, well, I'm just going to go on my back porch and give up all these ideas about being an artist in a big studio and just make little teapots. And so I went on my back porch and I started making these teapots, and I put them in environments. Like, I made a barn teapot and put it in a barnyard, and I made a cloud teapot and put it in the sky, and I made a moon teapot and put it in the sky over a cityscape. And I don't have pictures of those, unfortunately. Anyway, I had a show of those in Winston-Salem, and it was embarrassing. Everybody was showing in New York and wanted to be in New York, and I was having this little show in Winston-Salem. But one of the people that came to that show was Donald Anderson, who has this wonderful program in New Mexico. It's called A Gift of Time, and you get a year, a studio, all the supplies that you need, and a monthly stipend. And his best friend was Haynes Hosiery, who was based in Winston-Salem. And Donald Anderson happened to come and visit him while I had my show there, and he bought three pieces. And I called the gallery. I was really shocked that anything had sold, and I asked who bought the pieces, and they said it was Donald Anderson. And then I applied for that grant and got it, and it just set me free. I was making functional work. I was kind of approaching making sculpture, but I was still attached to functional work. And when I got the Roswell grant, I left my husband and just moved to New Mexico.
Well, I think, Bev, you know, this is so wonderful that you're sharing, these things, because, you know, in some ways, the setbacks were springboard to very positive things. And I think that's the word I kind of want to bring up in this show is, and I think it's true for you, is a tenacity to stay on course, even with the setbacks. And I think that's really, I know we don't want to use the word success or mature, but there's something about that as an MO, possibly a procedural process to develop and find yourself and find where you're going. And I think that's all, I think is extremely important for not only young artists and mid-career artists to hear, but sometimes it creates new, you know, the disappointments possibly creates new avenues for success. And I wanted to ask you, before the ceramics works, were you working in other mediums, or did you just fall into that in school? What was your journey through the mediums there?
Well, it's kind of always been clay. When I was 16, there was an Ontario College of Art. It's still there in Toronto. And I had gone to summer camp, and I met a counselor there who was at the Ontario College of Art, and she suggested I take a pottery class. So I did, and I was about 16, I think, or maybe 15, and I took it at night. And then I would always write poems in my bedroom at night. And when I didn't finish high school, in Canada, you can get a junior or senior matriculation. And I only got a junior matriculation, which meant I was headed to art college, Ryerson Technical Institute, where I could become a journalist or a school teacher. And I was really torn between going to Ryerson in journalism or going to art college in interior design. And I ended up going to art college. And one of the classes, of course, we had to take crafts. and I took ceramics, and just the smell of that room, the people, the medium, I just never left ceramics, and it's always been ceramics after that.
Wow, thanks for that. I mean, the way we're speaking about this, and this is something that's so big for me, is the sensuality of the experience and the process, and that led you, it was kind of like your path. I mean, just saying how you said it, you know, the smell of the room, I mean, I think that's very important for an artist. I mean, it's not just a visual artist too, but it's this sensual life. And I think that's
right.
Really, really important. And sometimes I think a lot of people don't even understand that about an artist in general, never mind artists themselves. And I think that's so crucial. Sheila, why don't you tap into that? And you have another question for Bev?
Yeah, well, I remember when Paul, your husband at that time, said, Beverly, it's time to end your love affair with clay, and I didn't like you were going to move on to some serious medium, but you thank God you never did. So when you got to Roswell, what did they have? Like, you had Erin with you, first of all, your daughter, and what did they have there for you?
I had a house. I got there and I couldn't believe it because I thought I was going to the mountains, and it's just like West Texas. It's just the ugliest place you can imagine. It's flat and there are no trees. It's just really barren. And they had bought these houses from an old barracks in an Army or an Air Force base that had closed down in Roswell. And so they were little kind of tract houses, kind of in a circle. And we'd have to go out and burn our trash in these big 55-gallon drums. It was just like this kind of bleak place. But the people, there were, I think, five or six other artists other than myself. And they were all painters and sculptors. And I was with a fantastic group of people. And I had a house, and I had a stipend every month. I didn't have to worry about making any money. I had all the supplies that I wanted. They had a kiln for me. It was just, I had no obligations whatsoever. Nobody checked up on me. Nobody said you had to talk about your work every Friday night. I could use the money, my stipend, for whatever I wanted. So it was a completely free, it was just the best year of my whole life. And it's interesting to be looking back over a life that's been creative and see where it all fits in, because that year was so important to me work-wise. Like, I just dared to become a sculptor. I just dared to do something I would never have done if I hadn't had that year.
Wow, so everything changed, and then you went to Chama.
And then I got an artist-in-residence grant to go to Chama and be an artist-in-residence resident in the schools, and that meant that I gave 2 weeks a month to the school system up there, and that was really difficult. I went to towns where they didn't speak English. Nobody wanted me to be there. I was making twice as much money as the school teachers, and they all resented me. It was a very difficult year, but I managed to save enough money that year to move to Albuquerque and support myself for about 10 months after that. So it was good in the long run, but it was difficult.
Mm. Yeah, you know, we've said on the show many times that I think people underestimate the resourcefulness of creative people, and I think because of the way our culture sees us as culture marginalized, you know, in several ways, and I think that's, you know, the few of the things you use those, you know, major words, you know, like freedom and the ability to do the thing that you love most, and that's being creative and making art, and I think, you know, that's like the best advice, I think, for any artist is to seek that road where you have the opportunities to free yourself, whether it's an artist in residence, which, you know, I've been really blessed in many ways to have, and also to kind of seek other opportunities, like the practicality thing, like I talked about in our introduction. Yes, to make a bit of money to kind of support your goals as a visual artist. And yes, I mean, that, you know, teaching has its ups and downs for sure. I think Sheila and I can have a whole show about that. But and Bev, we can call you in on that one. But it's just that kind of sacrifice. I guess the word I like to use is somewhat sacrifice in some ways. Now, now, how you've all these years you've continued to work, which obviously is glorious, and how do you see yourself now? Do you seek opportunities for shows, or how does that work? How are you keeping current in that sense?
Well, I'm not. I moved to the wilderness in 1993, and I lived there for 17 years, and I kind of dropped out, and I was making artwork. I had a gallery when I went to Apache Creek. That's where I moved to, and I had a gallery in Santa Fe after many years of not having a gallery, because when I decided to tile my house, I gave up all notions of, you know, I kind of took a vow of poverty, said I was just going to devote myself to tiling my house, which took 11 years to do.
Wow.
And I worked as a waitress during that time. And then when I moved to, it's funny because when I tiled my house, I wanted to make some figures for the yard. And I made these life-size garden ladies. And I don't have any pictures of those either, sorry. But they were life-size, and they were out in my garden, and people wanted to buy them. And I contacted a gallery in Santa Fe, and he came down and saw them, and he said he would give me a show of those. And then I moved away, but I had that gallery. So I had a few shows of patio furniture and small pots and small sculptures and those garden ladies. And that was my only gallery while I lived there. And then while I was there, I started writing. So I gave up the gallery and just devoted myself to writing for the next 12 to 15 years. I can't even remember now. I've been writing. So it's just recently that I've gotten back to work and with clay, and I don't know what I'm going to do. And, you know, I kind of don't care. I just kind of want to make the stuff.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, Bev, okay, so tell what life was like in Apache Creek.
Well, it was very isolated. I thought it was beautiful. We had a garlic and shallot farm, and just being outside under the big blue sky in this wilderness, I would hike the National Forest every day, and it was really... it was uplifting in terms of nature, and it was very hard in terms of people. The people there were very conservative. They're all Trump voters. They're mean, religious fanatics, and not pleasant. So people-wise, it was very hard. I never fit in. They, you know, I could have had a stamp on my forehead saying city girl from the minute I moved there. It was just really hard. So I don't miss it, but I was glad for that I had the, you know, it was a great adventure. It really was.
Well, in some ways, going into nature, which is something, of course, artists have been doing for centuries, was a support system. And that's kind of a question that kind of I had is this sense of, here you went into nature. I mean, artists are so stimulated by nature. In some ways, that was your, you know, your path as well. And do you find that? I mean, continually to do that. And if not, like, what other, like, support systems do you have that say go out there and do it. Because sometimes a lot of artists, you know, they kind of get in that rut of staying away from the work when it's right there in front of them. So do you have any other advice maybe on that?
You know, I think it's really different living in New Mexico, because New Mexico, you're not an other if you're an artist. Being an artist is accepted here. There's so much craft in Native American artwork, and Hispanics have a tradition of wood carving and retablos, and it's artwork is very respected, and it's kind of a part of life here. So I think the whole atmosphere of being in New Mexico is supportive. And then there are a lot of artists here, and I've met a lot through the university and just, you know, going to shows, and there's a lot of music, there's a lot of art, and there's sunshine every day. And so you can go out and you can, you know, go on hikes, and everything seems very easy in terms of supporting an artist's life. And lately I've started volunteering at Very Special Arts, which is a program, a daily program for adults who are physically and mentally extremely disabled. And just seeing that uninhibited approach to what they make with clay, it's really inspiring. So I just think the life here is inspiring.
Oh, that's such that's so important. Mm-hmm. It's so great. We're going to have to take a little break.
So we're going to talk when we get back.
A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. And I said that you can't always get what you want, honey. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want, but if you try sometime, well, you might just find.
You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park 94.3 FM. So, Bev, I want you to talk a little bit about writing when you were in Apache Creek, because I know that you didn't have anybody to talk to.
That's true. Well, I'll tell you how it started. One day I was sitting on my porch, and a neighbor drove up, and he said that a bear had dug up some bones, and a hunter had found these bones, and they had identified them as a couple that had gone missing of a year ago. And the story behind the couple was they were seedy characters, and they lived way out on the flats with no running water. They hauled their water, and they had a couple of goats. And their son had come to visit them from Montana, and he came at Thanksgiving, and the turkey was in the oven, and the table was set, and they were not there. And he hung around for 3 days, and they never came back, and so he reported them missing to the sheriff. And these were the bones that were dug up of that couple. And I went to bed that night, and I thought, what could have been the story behind that? There were 7 unsolved murders in the time that I lived in Apache Creek. And I thought, you know, this place, it was so kind of creepy. There was just like no law there. You didn't trust the sheriff. You didn't really trust anybody to have an ethical or a moral overview there. Everybody just did what they wanted. And so I thought, well, I'm going to write a book about that. And so I couldn't sleep all night. And the next morning I got up and I just started to write this story, which ended up being a horrible book, but it got me writing.
Well, you know, I think this is something that's been very important to Sheila and I on the show, is how, again, going back to that support, how other art forms can support your visual art. And in some ways, you know, whether it's tangential or not, you are able to find another avenue of expression. And I think this is really, really important for many, many artists. I mean, we keep diaries, we write poems. Many visual artists, of course, love music or play an instrument. So this is another thing that I think, again, the breadth of experience that creative people bring to their life journey is not just, you know, visual art. I mean, it could be something else. And I think that's a very, very remarkable and also a noble thing to do. Like, in some ways, sometimes it becomes another, like, river of creativity when the other one is dormant or maybe running dry, and then you go jump back and forth. So that's, thank you for sharing that. That's, yeah, I'm a little creeped out by that story myself. Now I want to go get the book. Now I'll make the judgment. I'll critique the book, Bev. You don't worry about a thing.
Well, you know, it's so funny because my feeling in myself and the feeling that I always want to put in my work is like the big joy. That's what I'm about. I'm about the big joy. And when I started writing, it just took me to the dark side. And then, you know, I've been in the dark side for 15 years. I want back to the big joy now.
Thank you for kind of the turning the table here on this show, because in the second part of the show, which you just introduced, I really want to get into the nitty-gritty about these philosophies. And I have to say, I love the way you just put that, the big joy. And how does that, contribute to this journey? Because, I mean, joy is firstly a beautiful word, and I don't think artists use it that much, actually.
No, they don't.
So Bev, kind of let's get into this philosophy of this, this journey. I'm trying to use the word journey, not to use some of the other words that you didn't want us to say on the show. But talk about this for you right now in your current evolution, if I could say that.
So when I was in graduate school, or my ex-husband was in graduate school, we took a trip into L.A. to see the Watts Towers, and I remember seeing them, and I got the chills. When I think of it right now, the hairs on my arms stand up. I just get all gooey. And the Watts Towers communicated something to me, and it was something that folk art communicates. It's not, it doesn't have a message. It's just a pure expression of the joy in life, or an observation of life without dogma, without message, without intellectual impact. It's just this, I just call it the big joy. And so I stuffed that aside because I wanted to have a career in New York. I wanted to be a big ceramic artist. And when the Tavelli brothers in Colorado sent back my work, which was years and years later, I was living in North Carolina. I was a waitress, and I was making pottery and little sculptures. And they sent back my work, and they were these huge sculptures. They were like 6 feet tall, and they were abstract ceramic sculptures. And they sent them back, and they said their reason was they would give me a show every year, but they now had David Hockney and Twombly and all these big-time artists, and they just didn't have room to have these big sculptures around. So I was devastated. I sat on my front porch steps, and I just thought, well, who am I, and what am I going to do? I cannot let this professional world define me as an artist. I just thought my ego is just so tender. I was just crushed. And I thought, fuck it. I'm just going to tile my house. I'm going to go to a tile store and I'm going to tile a design. I didn't think I would tile my whole house. I was just going to tile a design around my side door. And I went to the tile store and he said, yeah, we got all this stuff out in the dumpster. You can have it. And he gave me all the tile I needed to make that design. And then my neighbor, I thought, well, I'll just tile a little design over the front windows. And so I did that. And my neighbor had scaffolding. He was a junkyard man. And he brought the scaffolding over and he said, go for it. Cover the whole thing. So he brought me tile. People left tile at my front gate. It was just an amazing adventure. I got started on my own adventure. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about in terms of success, because I know that's what we're kind of leading up to here. I don't believe in success. It is just a word. And so is failure just a word. What we need to be on is our own adventure. And I think in terms of success, I think because my work has always been delightful, there's always been something delightful about it. Not profound, not smart, just delightful. And I think that it's always sold because of that. And some people would say I'm successful because of that. But I believe my work is so easily accessible. It's so easy to understand. And it's so delightful that it will never be considered great. So if we're talking in terms of success as a great artist, I will never be one. But I've had an amazing adventure. And I think that's what it's all about. And I think that, you know, like I've been dedicated to following my whims. And I've done that with gusto. That might sound trite, but I've been passionate about my whims, and it's just led me on a great adventure. So that's what I think success is.
Oh, that's like, wonderful.
Well, Bev, that's so beautiful. You said it perfectly. You know, I also know about you that you've had your work accepted, just what you were saying, ever since you started, and. And then starting to write at, you know, your tender age of whatever you were when you started. And then you had two serious illnesses. So I just wanted to touch on that and ask you if they changed you in any way, being really sick.
Well, fortunately, I was writing when I got cancer. And then, so I didn't have to do anything really physical. And you, I just hate to say this. I thought about this, but I'm going to say it because I kind of hate to say it. But, you know, when you have a serious illness like that, you're so grateful for every moment. You know, everybody says that. You're so grateful for every moment. Well, that lasts about 2 weeks. You know, then you're back in your life. And so I don't have that gratefulness for every moment and all that kind of romantic view of illness. I was ill, and it showed me my vulnerability, and it showed me how precious life is. But I don't hold on to it every minute. Like I just kind of went through it and then carried on.
Well, I think
I didn't reevaluate and said, okay, now I'm going to give up this, and now I'm going to, you know, embrace this, or just carried on.
You know, I think there's something profoundly beautiful what you just mentioned, because one of the things that you're really talking about, and it goes back to that really beautiful joy word you used. You know, you want to go to that side of life and maintain it, because your work is absolutely it's very joyful. And I think what you're kind of also mentioning, and I think I saw it immediately through your work, is to take away the cynicism. And I think that's what, you know, art kind of, you know, could take you down that road of cynicism as a creative person. And I kind of wanted to address this, because I don't see an ounce of this, and not only in the interview, but in your work. And I have on the script here that I was, you know, been really blessed to have older artists take me under their wing, and we became great friends, and they, you know, they've since passed on, but they were so bitter and cynical at the end of their lives that they weren't, you know, they had some shows in New York and they weren't acknowledged. They were you know, very, very down on the art world and down on their work at the end of their lives. And I think that is, like, to me, the biggest curse that I think an artist can have towards the end of their lives is to have that bitterness. It was profoundly destructive to me. Of course, I was a young artist, 20, 30 years younger than them, and we enjoyed each other's company. But that's something that I think really could muck up the end of one's a wonderful adventure, which is another word that you use that I really appreciate you using. It takes away and it kind of spoils and soils the journey in some ways. And I thank you for sharing that. Even though, you know, life, the journey's not necessarily a bowl of cherries to be trite, but, you know, and I think that's important.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I hear that all the time from writers. I haven't had any success as a writer. And writers are always complaining about how hard it is to get published and nobody buys their books. And, you know, it's I understand how that attitude can affect you. But, gosh, I thank God I've had all this time to write 4 books. I mean, it's amazing to me. I just don't see it that way. I don't, you know, I was once in a group and an older man said he felt like he was a failure. He'd never really accomplished anything in his art career. And somebody said to him, failure is just a word. And it is. It's just a word. And it's something we invented. I mean, I don't know. So is success just a word? They're just words.
Uh-huh. Well, Bev, I want to say, because you are a really fabulous writer, but one of the things that I want to bring up that I know Tom has kind of brought up early on is that all through your life, you've developed the tools that you need to do what you do and to find your expression. And in writing, I know you just started cold. You didn't have writing classes and stuff. And then I know that you had, that you were... went to workshops, you got some I forgot what you call those, not internships, but where you went in.
Fellowships,
the word. And so I wanted to for you to talk a little bit about how that was when you got started.
Well, I started, and then I sent my writing to the Iowa Writers' Workshop summer graduate class to see if I could go there. And I got accepted. And I was like 62 years old, and or 67, I can't remember. And there were all these young kids there. And we had to submit our writing, and I submitted mine. And the teacher said, well, this is okay. She said, but you don't know about point of view. And I thought, what is point of view? Like, I never heard of it. And I went out with these kids afterwards, and they started explaining point of view to me. And I realized that there was a craft to writing. And I was lucky enough, when I came back, that was 3 weeks. And when I came back, I went online, and I looked for other fellowships. And there was one in Los Angeles from Penn Center USA, and it was a 10-month fellowship to go and live in LA and meet other writers and go to UCLA and take a class. And so I did that. I got accepted to that. And I went, and when I went to UCLA, I had this professor that was outstanding. He just talked about the craft of writing. There is a real craft to writing, and he exposed me to it. And after that, I got another fellowship to go to Provincetown and write in Norman Mailer's house. And that was sort of...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I had the most... I was with five young guys in the fiction group. They were all from New York, and they were heavy duty. And, you know, they thought I was this ancient old lady. And a couple of them were nice to me, but mostly I was ignored. And I had a teacher, a mentor there from Chicago, and he was this fabulous guy and so tough. You know, like, he wanted you to write like Faulkner. And that was good too. And after that, I thought, it's for younger people, all those, you know, they need those fellowships more than I do. I have the time to write. And so I haven't applied for any more. But they gave me enough, I think. I think they gave me enough. I don't know.
Wow. Well, Bev, we only have a few more minutes on the show. And we wanted to kind of conclude with, this is the third show of our series on success in the visual artist, and I know you don't like that word, but that's the way we titled the show. But what kind of advice might you give a younger artist, or possibly a mid-career artist that's kind of like, you know, has a path, possibly not the confidence? What's kind of some quick tips you can maybe give them to maybe see their life, maybe, like, again, not a success, but how would you kind of plug in maybe that adventure word for them and to help them through, you know, those rough times that visual artists have?
Okay, I thought of a couple of things. If you have an artistic drive, don't deny or stifle it. Indulge it and encourage it, because you'll be miserable if you don't acknowledge it and go for it. And then develop work habits, maybe rituals. Like, I never start working until I clean my studio. It might take 3 days. I get it spotless. I just have a ritual, and you can develop your rituals to help you get in the mood. And never look out. Don't look out. Keep looking in. It's all inside you. You just have to follow your intuition. And respect the life that's been offered to you. We just live in this time where it's possible to explore ourselves. And I don't think it's always been that way. I think life's been too difficult, too closed off. But now there's this huge, the word creative is just everywhere. So indulge it and respect it. And trust your intuition. That's the most important thing, because you can waste a lot of time if you're not true to yourself. And Tom, I listen to you every week, every time you're on the air, and I know your intuition is towards certain types of art, and I know Sheila's is too, and we just, and mine is too, and we just need to be trustful of that and explore it, and don't say no to anything, but carefully select what you, where you put your energy. That's all. And then I have this, do we have time for this wonderful quote from Rilke?
Go for
and
it.
People should read this, Letters to a Young Poet. And Rilke writes about looking inward, and he says, "What more shall I say to you? Everything seems to me to have its just emphasis. And after all, I do only want to advise you to keep growing quietly and seriously throughout your whole development. You cannot disturb it more rudely than by looking outward and expecting from outside replies to questions that only your innermost feeling and your most hushed hour can perhaps answer."
Wow, thank you so much. Did I cut you off? No, I don't think I did. But Bev, that is the most profound way to end the show, and I don't think we don't want to go any further after that one. We can't thank you enough, Sheila and I and Bobby here in the studio. It's been great. And
I thank you so much. This has been really fun, and I also thank you for the Rolling Stones.
Yes,
oh,
we thought of you. That was
for
Sheila.
For you. Bev, I want to say that you and I, because of our lifelong friendship, we have almost like a pledge to each other that we will be artists for our whole lives. And
I know
it's so important to me that you're there and that you've done it, and that I think I've done it too. So
I feel
you.
The same way, Sheila.
All
I really
right.
do.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much again, Bev. And, you know, we conclude our series with this wonderful quote that Beverly McGinnis gave us, our artist, special guest, and we want to thank everyone for listening on our Success in the Visual Artist, and we hope we enjoyed the show. And Sheila, just to talk real briefly about our next show.
Sure. There's a big show at the National Gallery on Jacopo Tintoretto, and it was delayed because of the government shutdown, but it's up now, and it's going to be fabulous. It's like, so Tintoretto was one of the three great Italian painters in the Renaissance, Tintoretto, Titian, and Veronese. And then, of course, there were others. But we are going to, he was a crazy artist in a very Italian crazy way. And so, but he left this world a better place with his paintings and drawings. So our show will concentrate how good drawing always makes for good painting. And we will see you next week.
Okay.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. My friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway and more. Much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, and saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more. much more than this. I did it my
And thanks again to Tom and Sheila for another wonderful edition of Art as Experience. You are tuned to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park.